Blog Talk Radio.
3, 2, 1. A new television series inspired by Silence of the Lambs comes to CBS tomorrow night. Clarice is the name, Jenny Lumet is the co-writer and executive producer, and she joins me next in an internet radio exclusive. Chain Reaction is the game show you can't keep down for good. A week from Monday, Game Show Network will bring its third reaction run to life, with First Reaction MC Dylan Lane back in the chain lane. We'll check in with Senior Vice President James about this development and more games ahead next half hour. And how about this? Masterpiece Theater hits the half-century mark this year on PBS. We'll celebrate this milestone in our final 30 minutes with University of Missouri professor and Masterpiece expert Dr. Nancy West. Also ahead, opening news of NBC Universal's Olympics plan this summer, a burst of new HBO Max tunes, and our new classic trivia question. Hello, everyone. I'm Simon Applebaum, simulcasting live from New York on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker Internet Radio, and presented on the iHeartRadio Podcast Network, Amazon Music, and Verbal. This just in, tomorrow will be televised. Brought to you by Audible.com, the leading provider of spoken audio entertainment information that will transform the way you hear the world. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book or two when you sign up for a 30-day trial at audibletrial.com/televised. More details later in our program. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday for a special 90-minute edition of Tomorrow Will Be Televised, the program all about TV's current and future. The blockbuster program for you today, a lot of great guests, and we invite you to be part of the program. It's so simple. Pick up the phone and use this number, 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. The number is good anyway. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, here on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and Tuner Radio. Shy about the phone? No problem. Use our chat room to get your thoughts across. It's SimonApple04 by name, and you can find it at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And while the promo is on the air, you can connect others by using Facebook Timeline. Click on the Facebook icon on your Blog Talk speaker, tune in, stream, follow the instructions, and other things we live with you. Jane the Man is live with us from Santa Monica, California, after these news notes. How will NBC Universal cover this year's Summer Olympics from Tokyo? The first details were made public this morning. NBCU is planning more than 7,000 hours of live and taped content starting July 23rd with opening ceremonies. Those ceremonies will air live in their entirety on NBC, starting at 6:55 a.m. Eastern, 3:55 a.m. Pacific. A two-hour Today program will follow immediately, then move to event coverage and features for 3 hours. NBC will replay the opening ceremonies in primetime that night, inserting special Team USA reports. An overnight rebroadcast will follow. NBC Sports will disclose its entire coverage plans, incorporating NBC, cable networks, Telemundo, and Peacock, early this summer. Three new HBO Max animated series got the green light earlier today. Scooby-Doo character Velma gets her own tune, voiced by Mindy Kaling, who will also executive produce. Future-minded workplace comedy Fired on Mars will have Saturday Night Live player Pete Davidson as lead voice. The third series is Clone High, a two-season update of the cult history and high school parody. Separately, current HBO Max adult tune Close Enough, one of the Mega Content Ventures' first original attractions, is now set for two more rounds of episodes. Close's second season begins on February 25th. We will have more news notes, our quickies, at the bottom of the hour. Our first guest today has a lot of TV credits in, well, rapid short fashion. She's an executive producer on Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access. Next month becomes Paramount Plus. A consulting producer on Star Trek Picard, one of its offshoots. She did a short Trek also as well. She is now the executive producer and writer of the new Silence of the Lambs-inspired series Clarice, which premieres tomorrow night at 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific Time on CBS. But also, she is now the executive producer and writer of the new Paramount Plus adaptation of The Man Who Fell to Earth, the cult movie, which a few days ago just got its man, who will be the man who fell to Earth for that version. And maybe most importantly, she is an award-winning screenwriter whose work on in film, Rachel Getting Married, won several New York Critics Awards, also Critics Awards in Toronto, Washington, other places. And most importantly, she is the daughter of one of the great filmmakers of all time and live TV makers before that, Sidney Lumet. It is a pleasure to welcome this program, joining us live from Santa Monica, California, in Airway Exclusive, Jenny Lumet. Jenny, welcome in.
Hey, Simon, how are you? And that was a lovely intro, and my favorite part was hearing about my dad. You're in New York. I've been in New York my entire life, except for the past 2 years I moved out here. I miss it. Hello, New York City. I love you.
Thank you so much, Jenny. And your father was, I would say, the quintessential New York film and TV maker. And when you think of his wonderful catalog of work from his first film, or one of his first movies, 12 Angry Men, which was based on the famous TV play by Rachel Rose, Long Day's Journey in Tonight, Daniel, one of my favorite films of recent years, Running on Empty, that was on Turner Classic Movies a few weeks ago, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, like I said, the quintessential New York film, and before that, Live TV Maker. What's it been like for you, Jenny, to do Clarice? It was over a year ago, as a matter of fact, that you and Alex Kurtzman, your writing and producing partner, got the go-ahead from CBS to do it. What's it like for you now, a day and a half before it premieres?
It's been such a crazy journey because, you know, we were, I think, a day and a half out of shooting pilot when COVID hit and we had to shut everything down. So, and that kind of 8 months or no, not so many months, however many months that was, that gave us actually this really cool time to be with the cast and kind of, we Zoomed and we hung out on weekends. And that part was kind of great. You know, Clarice, I mean, I remember when she stepped into my psyche, but I'm sure all of us remember where they were and how old they were when they saw Silence of the Lambs, because that movie really changed the landscape. And I kept thinking, who is this woman? Who is this woman who is somehow able to go into the darkest places and pull out the light and yet somehow disappear from screen for 30 years and yet remain in the consciousness? I mean, I kind of feel like so many female like detectives that we see on TV are daughters of Clarice. And I found that combination of mystery, who is she? And how did she keep winning? She kept winning. Where has she been? Like, why has she been silent? It's been pretty extraordinary. It's been pretty extraordinary. I reached out to Mr. Harris, and by reached out to him, meaning that I email stalked him for, you know, weeks until he very graciously responded to me. There was some very specific stuff I wanted to know about, or I wanted to ask him about Clarice. And to be able to play, work, and be in the Thomas Harris universe is one of the great creative joys. It really is.
In creating this series, what was the most important revelation that you want the viewers to know about Clarice, about what makes her tick?
I can't spoil some stuff, but if you read the book and if you look at the movie, it's incredibly fast-paced, and there's almost no moment where Clarice even sits down or has something to eat. She's really quite extraordinary. What drove me was the mystery. What's not in the book? And the questions that I had were kind of, did she ever go home and have a holiday dinner with her parents, or did she eat every meal in the FBI Academy? Who are her friends besides the wonderful Ardelia Mapp? What was it like to be the only sibling who was sent away after the death of her father? What does she really know about the night her father died? What does she really know about her mother? Why is she such a silent presence? So this woman has a whole life. She has a whole backstory that was never in the book and never in the movie because she had no time. If you're going to watch the show, you're going to learn where she came from and how she got so freaking brave to be a monster hunter and the sort of the first female monster hunter in 1993. Because I think it's a really sort of cool question. I mean, if you look at the guys in the Harris universe, they're all extraordinary. Some are operatic. Some are tragic. And yet you have this sort of Persephone character in Clarice, who won and then disappeared like a ghost. And so if you want to know how this woman became this woman at age 25 and what she's doing in the 7 years between Silence of the Lambs and when she reappears finally in Hannibal, then you should watch the show because we go very, very deep into her psyche. She's a very interesting person.
Also interesting, Jenny, is that your series is debuting a few days after The Equalizer, return of that series, debuted Super Bowl Sunday on CBS. And when you look at it, both programs are alike in this way. They are as much character study as it is espionage drama, spy drama, crime drama, procedural. How do you balance the two? I'm way back when in the original series, I had a chance to meet Edward Woodward, the star, and Jane McAdam, the executive producer, marvelous, I think a sensational producer. And they realized off the bat that in order to make this series work, it had to have the atmosphere of New York, but it also had to have it be a character study where every episode, forever, you get to know more about the character. And that takes the precedence over the case that happens throughout the course of the episode that has to be revealed at the end of and solved at the end of the hour. How do you, as both writer and producer, balance out the character study of Clarice with the you have to have a crime in every week which she solves?
Well, I'm infinitely more interested in the character of Clarice, and it is the character of Clarice that sent her into law enforcement and into this particular branch of law enforcement in the first place. Why did she make these choices? Will there be cases? Certainly. And there is one overarching case that exists for the whole season. But no case, and certainly not the overarching case, they're all reflections of what's going on within Clarice internally. So it's always a character study of her. I mean, is it scary? Yes. Is it gory? Yes. Are there gunfights and cop stuff? Absolutely. And shootouts? Yes. But what we have that doesn't exist anywhere else is this particular woman. And why? Why did she go down those stairs in the very beginning of Silence of the Lambs? What drove her to do that? She asked, there were two really powerful questions that did not get answered for me. And my goal is to, I don't know if it's to answer them in the series, but at least ask more. Clarice asked herself, at one of the lowest points, what the hell do I want this badly? And she was asked by the famous cannibal, what do you do with all your rage? And I thought, well, if those aren't two freaking great questions, then I don't know what are. Everything that Clarice does within her workspace is motivated by something that's eating at her in her personal life. In her personal space, and dealing with the trauma of Bill. I mean, you don't go into that kind of space. You don't go into a basement and hear those sounds and smell those smells and hear the echo off that wall. And, you know, the clicking of Precious's claws on the stone floor. There's only two people in the world who have ever heard and experienced that and lived. What does that leave you with? And what does it mean when you look in the face of the worst that humanity has to offer? How do you carry that? That, and how do you bring that to work? And what do you do with that at work? That, to me, is the coolest stuff ever. And it's very, I think, within the Harris universe. What I love is how emotionally grounded he always remains, which for me is the reason that his extraordinary villains work so well. Because you always feel that there are human beings chasing them, and there are human beings in some way, too.
We're talking with Jenny Lumet. She is the executive producer and main writer of Clarice. It's the brand-new CBS series inspired by Silence of the Lambs that premieres tomorrow night in the local CBS station, 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific time. Jenny joins us live from Santa Monica, California, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Tomorrow I'm with you live from Nueva York. We're happy to have you with us. 34 degrees at the top of the hour, by the way, right here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker Tune Radio. And we want to hear from you, so give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04, by name, our good friend Rick Webb from Philly, already in the room. We are just getting started, beginning of a big 90-minute edition of our program coming your way this midweek. We have one more edition coming up this week. It'll be happening on Friday. And joining us will be the people behind a brand-new series on Amazon called The Hunter's Anthology. A very unusual anthology drama that premieres on Friday. We'll have the producer, Arezou Akmal, and we'll have the writer and director, Robert Smithline. And then, remember Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV? Well, we got the person who put that together. His name is Eric Fogel, and he's working on a project for Peacock now as executive producer. It's a new tune called Archibald's Next Big Thing is Here. All of that coming your way Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Jenny, Rebecca Breeds plays Clarice. What did you and Alex see in her that immediately came to mind, yes, this is the person that we want to play Clarice?
Well, Interestingly, we had the same reaction to Rebecca Breeze as we did to Devin Tyler when they walked in the room, which is like, oh, here we are. We're good. And Rebecca was the last actor that we saw, the last one that we saw for Clarice. She has this extraordinary combination of steel. She is steely. I mean, Rebecca is no joke, and at the same time, she'll break your heart in about 15 places. You understand, just looking at Rebecca, how she sees you. She lets you right in, and we were just kind of blown away because we go into some very dark places in series, and we needed someone who could carry that and balance it with their own light, and she does that. I mean, she just kind of walked in, and we were like, oh, well, cranky, and how are we gonna follow one of the great cinematic performances, and what kind of pressure will that put on the actor? And Rebecca is, I mean, she is just like, there is no stopping her, and I'm so happy for her because she's a lovely person and kind, and she's throwing herself into this. You know, we're very protective of her, like, Rebecca, you have to sleep. Rebecca, you have to hydrate. Like, all this kind of stuff. She's really kind of extraordinary. And her knowledge of the Harris world was pretty profound when she walked in the room.
How much leeway did CBS give you in terms of exploring Clarice's world? And when people know about Silence of the Lambs, they know it's a very dark film. It's a very disturbing movie. And some of the TV series, like Hannibal, which was on NBC for several seasons, also sort of try to bring that dark atmosphere to it. I mean, I was curious, in putting this program together, how much leeway could you get to be as dark as you could without turning the audience off?
Well, when we originally envisioned it, we envisioned it as a streaming show, and David Nevins asked us or said it, that it would have more impact on network. And I think that he's right. We said to him, David, you know, we really need to make the show that we need to make. And he said, we're 100% with you, and they've been great. Of course, there are limits on network, but that was kind of exciting, too, in the sense that if you think about it this way, Clarice Starling is a woman in 1993. The FBI was 90% male and 90% white, like straight up. So she's operating under rules and regulations that are designed to hold her up and to sort of get in the way and hold her back. Any challenges that we've had to face being on network all kind of make sense in terms of, because Clarice is constantly surrounded by challenges, surrounded by what she can do and what she can't do. And they've been great. I mean, I'm kind of like, can we pull back? This is disturbing. And CBS has been pretty extraordinary, and I fully understand that we wanted to make a show about this woman, you know, and MGM has been amazing too. We wanted to make a show about her. We did not want to make a procedural, even though, interestingly, Silence of the Lambs is a procedural. It's about catching a killer before he kills again. It's just one of the greatest procedurals ever. So we knew that it couldn't feel like a case of the week, because that's not worthy of the world. And that's not worthy of Clarice, because she's not your detective of the week. I'm happy to say and thrilled to say that the CBS and the MGM guys have been kind of amazing.
Do you find it ironic that your series is based at a time in the 1990s when men ruled the roost, as you pointed out, and you're doing this show at a time when more and more women, especially women of color, are now executive producing and producing their own programs, whether it's on broadcast television, cable TV, Netflix, Hulu, Amazon, the mega content services like Apple TV Plus and so forth, where we're seeing just this breakout over the last couple of years, but especially the last 12, 24 months of women and women of color getting to do their own thing as producers and executive producers, create their shows in some cases for the first time on television, and even form their own production companies.
You know, a lot of times the thing that gives me the great joy is that I get to sort of say out loud, I'm 54 years old, I'm a black woman, and I'm not supposed to be here, yet here I am. And it makes me so freaking happy. Look, I think now is the perfect time. Clarice has been silent for 30 years. I don't think that without Black Lives Matter, without Me Too, without this global outcry of everything, I don't know if it would have been the right time for this show. And I know that this show is certainly a product of those ideas. Like, let's not do this anymore. We have to have different voices in the room. It's serving no one creatively. You just hear this, it is here over and over again, you know? I'm thrilled that my sisters of color blowing up left and right. And if it's about capturing this moment, okay, fine. We'll capture this moment and we'll hold on to it. And that means something because the world looks very, very different. And that's something we are so lucky to be able to have a show set in 1993 because we're looking at it from the prism of now. And you say, wait a minute, that she had no HR, she couldn't voice a complaint. How come there's only one black agent? And we have a whole storyline based on the black and Hispanic agents sued the FBI for discrimination in the early 90s. And that's what Ardelia Rapp is going to be tackling. So everything that's going on sort of right this very minute, a lot of those seeds were planted in 93. And it's really cool to be able to look at what she's going through from the perspective of now. And hopefully people will say, what are they kidding? They had no black people. What are they kidding? The women were treated like this. It's like, nope, this is what it was. This is what it was.
Jenny Lumet, the executive producer and writer of Clarice, coming on CBS tomorrow night, 10 p.m. Pacific time. She's our guest this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised, and we're delighted to have her. Simon Applebaum with you live from Nueva York, and if you have a question or comment or remaining moments with Jenny, make that call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. We're going to take a break on President's Day. That's next Monday. We usually would be on, but because of the holiday, we're moving it 24 hours later. Our next episode, first one of the week, actually, will be on Tuesday. And joining us will be the chief executive officer of that multi-channel bundle known as Xumo, Colin Petrie Norris, will be with us. Also, we'll talk to the founder and president of a new gaming app available on Samsung Smart TV sets called BCC Gaming. The parent company is called Enthusiast Gaming, and the founder and president is Menashe Kestenbaum, will be with us. And finally, we'll have the executive producer of a very controversial new HBO documentary series that is The Talk of the Town, The Lady and the Dale. Executive producer Andre Gaines will be aboard. By the way, it's also going to be running on HBO Max, too. That's all coming up next Tuesday, 90-minute edition of Tomorrow Be Televised, 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific, right here on Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, and TuneIn Radio. Jenny, the other project, of course, of note, which really came in early this week, is The Man Who Fell to Earth. You and Alex Kurtzman are involved in that, and a few days ago, you got your man.
We got our man. Our man is the extraordinary Chiwetel Ejiofor. Alex and I have been working on this show for 3 years. We've been writing for 3 years. And the rest of the cast is shaping up to be just as extraordinary as Chiwetel. So this is kind of like a dream come true. We should be shooting this summer in Spain and London. And, this is one where you keep pinching yourself saying, wait, is this really real? Is this really real? But, yeah. We're huge Walter Tavis fans, and you know he wrote the book of Queen's Gambit, which was so extraordinarily done. And the movie is so of that moment; it's so of 1975, and you have to. And it was so. He is the most David Bowie's most extraordinary thing in that movie, as I think that anybody would attest to. And we were thinking, how do we take this and move it along? The Bowie character, he's a unicorn, so you can't go chasing him. But what we knew what we needed to do was take this alien and make him less passive and more active. There's a passivity to the Bowie character. And Chiwetel Ejiofor plays the next alien to come from Anthea. And I can't even... Like, we've been writing this for so long, and we wrote a bunch of episodes and tore them up and started all over again. And as this is a streamer, there's a lot of freedom. And damn is all I can say. I'm really excited. excited.
We mentioned at the top that your father was one of the most incredible filmmakers around, the quintessential New York filmmaker. His versatility in terms of subject matter, from 12 Angry Men to Daniel to Serpico to Running on Empty, tremendous. Right up there with any other director you want to name. What about his work do you take into your work as a writer and producer?
Oh, well, all right, Simon, this is for real, and this goes some, this is on my family on both sides, and not many people know this, but here's the thing. On my mother's side, my grandmother's mother was a song and dance girl in the tent shows in the Deep South just after Reconstruction, for real. So she was in showbiz, my grandma was in showbiz, my mom writes books and sort of was spared the showbiz gene. My grandfather, Sidney's father, Baruch Lumid, in the Yiddish theater, dad is dad. So we've been doing this for 100 years, 100 years, on both sides of the family. It's a job. It's the best job in the world, but you get up and you go to work, you rehearse, you do your stuff, and then you come home and you go to bed. And it gives you this extraordinary perspective of how, number one, how lucky you are, but number two is get the job done. Get it done. This is work. It's not about you. It's not about you. You use you, but it's not about you. And I learned that at a really young age. My dad would go to work at 6:30 in the morning, and he would be home for dinner at 6:30 every night because he was always prepared. You know, he had 2 weeks of rehearsal built into the schedule. He never would, there was no, you go to set and just wing it. Let's see what happens. None of that. This is a guy who, as you know, started in theater and then went and served in World War II and then came back and got into live TV. And in live TV, you don't have time to mess around. So you have to, you know, you have three cameras and you're editing in your head while you're shooting. So he learned that there. Before that, I don't know if you know this, he was taught to fix movie projectors in Burma in the army, which probably led him to CBS. So it was all about do your job. Just do your job. You're lucky to have this amazing job. Do your job. I mean, we've been freelance for practically a century, you know. So it's about who's working. We're pretty lucky like that.
And also, too, about the fact that you can adapt to the material as your father did. And also, I should point out that your father also came back to television toward the end of his career to a wonderful series for A&E called 100 Center Street, which was one of the first television programs to be taped in high definition. And it ran for two seasons with a brilliant Alan Arkin and a wonderful cast, some of whom you can still see on shows like Law & Order Special Victims Unit and other places. Really tremendous cast. So it's interesting that, you know, he was always able to adapt to the situation he got, whether it was a film or TV situation. He was always able to adapt. And I think it's the same way with you, because you've done science fiction, you're doing, you know, dark crime, you're doing, something like The Man Who Fell to Earth, which is sort of like an oddball kind of experience. And so it seems like you're able to adapt to the moment or to the materials moment.
Well, 100%. I feel like the more things that I know how to do, do I know how to write a network TV show? Yes, I do. Do I know how to write a streaming show? Yep. And I know how to write a big fancy movie, and I know how to write a movie like Rachel Getting Married. The more I learn, the more I know how to do, especially as a woman of color, the better off that I am. And my dad always took jobs, and he would tell me this. I mean, look, there are probably jobs that he did for the money. There were certainly jobs that he did for the money. But he said that he took every single job to learn something. I mean, I remember him saying he took one movie to learn how to use color, because he was started in black and white. And he took one movie to learn how to use a certain kind of lens. He took every movie to learn a thing, and then he could bring those skills to the next movie. So it was all about building your skill set. As opposed to, I guess, imposing a vision. It was like, what can I learn? What can I learn? What can I learn? And I think that's really cool. And I think it keeps you really, I would assume it keeps, look, he's a really grounded guy. And I guess today's language doesn't necessarily make sense for his generation. He'd say, grounded? What are you talking about? I don't even know what that means. But he, can I learn? And how can I bring it to the next thing?
Clarice, coming your way tomorrow night with Rebecca Breeds in the title role, the Signs of the Lambs inspired drama, and it begins tomorrow night in your local CBS station, 10 p.m. Eastern and Pacific time. Don't forget to check your local listings for the CBS station in your area. For more details, CBS.com. And don't forget Star Trek Discovery on CBS All Access, which coming in March becomes Paramount Plus, also Star Trek Picard, and coming up either later this year or in 2022, The Man Who Fell to Earth. Jenny Lumet, thank you again for joining us. It's been a pleasure all the way. Next time, we've got to have you for a full hour. It has been a delight. Congratulations on Clarice and your other work also with your cast and crew. And hopefully, Clarice, a very long run starting tomorrow night, and we would love to have you back anytime.
Simon, I will talk movies with you any time of the year, so just anytime. Thank you so much. I had a great night.
Same here. Jenny, all the greatest. Starting tomorrow night. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Jenny Lumet from Clarice, joining us live from Santa Monica, California. When we come back, Game Show Network's up to a lot of things this year, including the third revival of Chain Reaction, which begins in a couple of weeks. We will talk to Jay James, the Senior Vice President of Programming, Production, and Other Things at GSN. He will join us live, also from Santa Monica, California, plus our new classic trivia question. Stand by, you can win a couple prizes and more. We'll do all that after we pause at the bottom of the hour for web identification. You're connected to the best internet radio on the planet, www.blogtalkradio.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn.com. Together, reaching over 50 million listeners around the world every month and growing. Don't forget, TuneIn Radio is your home for the coronavirus news channel. Get the latest word on what is happening with the virus all over the mundo and all over the globe, plus podcasts, original material, much, much more. The coronavirus news channel 24/7, TuneIn Radio, at TuneIn.com. Welcome back to our second 30 minutes of Tomorrow Be Televised, 90-minute edition coming your way on this Wednesday afternoon. Simon F. Bunn with you live from New York. More guests coming your way in the hour ahead. And if you have a question or comment, ring it in, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Jay James from Game Show Network will join us live again from California. But first, let's give you a bunch of news note quickies. Disney Plus will create a new Swiss Family Robinson television series. John Chu and Ron Moore will co-executive produce. Robinson will be Moore's first project under a new long-term content creation pact with Disney's 20th television unit. He will maintain a relationship with For All Mankind on Apple TV, starts second season later this month, and Outlander on Stars. Mayor of Easttown, the HBO miniseries starring Kate Winslet, premieres April 18th. Another HBO attraction this spring, the new version of In Treatment featuring Uzo Aduba. That will be coming in May. Animal Planet's latest Puppy Bowl had 2.1 million viewers aged 2 and up this past Super Sunday, up 14% from 2020. The popular Redwall books by Brian Jacques will become a Netflix miniseries soon, plus a original animated movie. Jim Barnes, one of The Walking Dead's writers and executive producers, will take on a new TV series for AMC Networks under a just-announced deal there. Knowing show business manager Dre London will step into the TV-making world. His entry point is High Heels, a crime saga set in Memphis. And Beachbody, one of the newest players in the interactive fitness TV movement, will go public via three-way merger with cycling equipment maker Mix and a SPAC, that's Special Purpose Acquisition Company, including former Disney and TikTok executive Kevin Mayer, who serves on that as strategic advisor. And that is news notes for today. Our next guest is the Senior Vice President of Programming, Production, and all sorts of other things at Game Show Network. Over the last 2 years, GSN has put on a whole bunch of new game shows, and they're all working from America Says to Get a Clue to Common Knowledge to Masterminds to, more recently, the Leah Remini-hosted series People Puzzler. And now GSN is a week or so away from bringing back for the third time Chain Reaction. It's a game show that just keeps on ticking. Joining us live from Santa Monica, California, Jay James. Jay, thanks for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thanks, Simon.
You're very, very welcome, Jay. So this is a third time charmer, we hope, for Chain Reaction.
Yeah, we hope so. We love the show. The 2006-2007 version plays in daytime on the air with Dylan Lane and does really well, and even though I don't know how many times that show has been repeated. And so as we looked for things that had a high comfort factor for our audience And that, to me, has one of the best game show formats of all time. It was kind of a no-brainer to try and bring it back and do a version that was pretty close to the version that the audience had already demonstrated a real fondness for.
Before we get into why you decided to bring it back and bring Dylan Lane back for the first time in 14 years, why has this particular show, created by Bob Stewart, and started in 1980 with Bill Cullen as the host, on, it was on NBC, then it went on USA Network, and at the same time was on in Canada with Jeff Edwards and I think Blake Emmons as the host for like 4 or 5 seasons. Then it comes to GSN down the road. Why has this particular game just kept on going and keeps getting revived and revived?
I think it's just because of that game mechanic. It just the simple fact that people enjoy stringing words together. It's just very sticky. And in our building, we call it an elevator game. And what I mean by that is a lot of times you go to take an elevator and you see a crowd of people staring at the screens because we have TV monitors across from the elevator doors. And when people willingly let their elevator go because they're so enwrapped with the puzzle and they're trying to solve it, there's something about that that grabs people. And it grabbed them in the first version, and it still grabs them today. And when you just have a great play-along format like that, it's just kind of undeniable. And so for us, the real challenge was just keeping it pure and getting out of the way of it and not messing it up by throwing too many bells and whistles at it and just trying to stay with that pure game.
When you made the call with your fellow executive colleagues to bring Chain Reaction back, was Dylan Lane right in the call, or was it after a little bit of, who do we have hosting? Let's bring Dylan back for the first time in 14 years.
Well, you couldn't discuss Chain Reaction without him because that was the version that we were super focused on. And so he was definitely in the conversation from the beginning. But as is natural, when you're doing a reboot, you're looking at rebooting everything. And the question came up of, well, is there a host that might better fit the show, better fit where the network is right now? And after we went through a certain process on that, we just kept coming back to, but what about Dylan? What about Dylan? And I always really appreciated his performance in the version that he did. He was very funny in an understated way, and he just made the show work in a way that you didn't see him working. He was such a natural. And so, it was really a question at that time because we knew he was out of show business, and he was working as an environmental engineer for General Electric, married with 2 kids in Schenectady, New York. And we knew that, if and when we called him, it would certainly be from left field. And that's certainly how he took it. He was definitely tickled when we called, but he was like, wow, this is a unforeseen development. Let me talk with my wife. Let me figure it out. Let me figure out how it could work with my job and get back to you. And then he called us a couple of days later and said, you know what, I'm up for it. Let's see if we can make this happen. And we're quickly able to put everything in place. He was able to get a leave of absence from his work. And the way we work, we do 65 shows in a month's time, and that includes a week of rehearsal. So really in 3 weeks, we're doing 6 shows a day and pumping them out. It certainly helped in that regard that for Dylan, it was like riding a bike. It was just so familiar to him. He slipped back into the role, and he's more mature now, and he's got more references, and he didn't demonstrate any self-doubt. He just knew it. He knew the show, and it also helped that other than the final act of the show and the end game, we didn't change the format one bit. So because it works, so it was easy for him. And it's just a great story. It's just a great story to bring him back, all these years later when he thought, his days in hair and makeup and with cameras on him were through. And he did a great job. And we had a lot of fun working with him.
What was it like for him to face the cameras for the first time in so long. And, you know, hi, welcome to Chain Reaction, the game of such and so on and so forth.
Right. I think, you know, at first, because also the set is much bigger than what he had been used to the last time around. It was a pretty small theater in the round. Because of COVID, we weren't able to have audience, but we still wanted to convey the theater in the round concept. So they're big LED circular walls around him, and just, you know, a lot more, I'd say, sizzle going on stage. And so it was a little surreal for him at first, but there's like no time to kind of get lost in your thoughts when you're out there. And especially, we start him off somewhat easily on the first day. We only do two or three shows. But by day two, we're doing five. By day three, we're doing six. And so you're already in the teens. You know, by the end of day three, you've already put down, you know, 12 to 15 shows. And you're already in the groove. And he found his groove really quickly. And you know, as happens with a lot of our hosts, you know, we get to the end of the run and they're like, whoa, is that it? Are we done? You know, because it's such a whirlwind. And but he did a great job.
And you can see it starting on Monday, February 22nd, 5 p.m. Eastern time on Game Show Network. We're talking about the new version of Chain Reaction, third one for Game Show Network. We've got one of the key people from the network with us this half hour on Tomorrow We Televised, Jay James. He's Senior Vice President of Programming, Production, all sorts of things. And if you have a question or comment for him, well, make that phone call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Once again, we're coming your way for one more episode this week on Friday. And joining us then will be the producer and the writer-director of a new Amazon series called The Hunters Anthology. It premieres on February 12th. We'll have the producer, Arizu Akmal, and also the writer-director, Robert Smithline. And then, remember Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV? Very popular stop-motion series where famous celebrities got into the wrestling ring and did all sorts of crazy things. Well, that man, Eric Fogel, will be with us because he's got a brand-new project he's executive producing for Peacock. Yes, it is an animated program. And it's called Archibald's Next Big Thing is Here. It's all coming up Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What's it been like, by the way, to not only produce Chain Reaction, but People Puzzler, other shows under these pandemic conditions, and particularly in a state like California, which has been really, really reeling from how the pandemic's been treated?
It is intimidating, let's just put it that way, because, you know, the stakes are super high, but at the same time, you want to figure out how can you push forward safely. You get a lot of people to work, which is a great thing about it, but obviously you don't want to put anybody at risk. And so, you know, our production management team is really great and working hand in hand with the production management and risk people and COVID planners at Sony, which own our channel. They were able to put, you know, great protocols in place where we were able to get basically a soundstage where we had all four corners of the soundstage. And so we knew that everybody who came in the studio gates, because we had several shows going at once, everybody who came in those studio gates had been tested. All the contestants had to be tested the day before they'd appear. You know, and we had strict protocols for the hosts. They had little pods that really just had their hair, makeup, and stylist in them. Only one producer was allowed to be near them. And then that producer was not allowed to be near anybody else as far as prepping the hosts. And then, you know, we were very careful with social distancing and ventilation and what have you on the stages. And all that was taken into account. You know, that starts with the set designs to even how the blueprint for the studio is mapped out in terms of the access and the walkways for the talent and their pod need to be protected versus, you know, the other folks working on stage. And then you're also looking at having the most minimal number of people there as possible. And then within the control rooms, the control room, because we were in a soundstage, we were able to build our own, was twice the footprint as normal. So everything could be spaced out, and every single desk for each individual there had its own like plexiglass three-walled shield around it. So everybody was kind of encased. And, you know, it's really weird at first. Also, everybody's wearing shields and masks and all that sort of thing. And it's bizarre, but you know, you're busy and you get to work. And before you know it, you just kind of take it for granted that this is the way things are. And yeah, I think the biggest loss is just not being able to hang out at the craft service table, which is one of my strengths, and just chat with people, you know, up close in between shows. Everybody's got to maintain that space. But luckily, you know, and luckily we're making formatted shows where there's no movement on the stage. So as long as we had people spaced, one of the things we're giving up that we love is when the hosts get physically close to the contestants. You know, one of the things in our Masterminds format, you know, Brooke Burns loves to just like put her hand on the shoulder of a contestant when they're going for the grand prize and encourage them. We're not able to do that sort of thing anymore. Or John Michael Higgins on America Says loves to get up really close with the contestants and lean on the podium and have fun with them and kibitz a little bit. Not able to do that sort of thing anymore. But still, the shows come off great. So we're just happy we're able to push forward and do it in a safe way.
Yeah, you can also see that, for example, I know you run the reruns of Family Feud, and I've seen the new episodes this year, and you can see Steve Harvey was struggling, at least at the beginning, with, you know, not being able to get close to the contestants, not being able to do his thing at the podium, because the podium was split more further apart with the contestants. Mm-hmm. And and particularly during the Fast Money round, you could tell, like, I can't put my arm around that person's shoulder.
I know. And it's also for the team.
Everybody's trying. So
everybody's trying. And yeah, but the big thing for us, because, you know, every time we make a show, we're planning on having it in reruns for a long time. We didn't want to look back and have the shows look dated, like, oh, that's a COVID show. And so we made a hard and fast rule from the beginning that if we have to put plexiglass on the stage, we're just going to wait until we don't have to do that. And luckily, we were able to come up with designs we're able to work around those things. But it's not just the host, it's also the teams, because sometimes you have a team and they win and they're used to hugging and high-fiving and all that kind of stuff, and now they just kind of high-five in place. So we kind of coach them to be like cheerleaders. Like, cheerleaders get excited and they jump up and down and wave their arms and sort of stuff. They're not hugging, so just kind of celebrate cheerleader style.
One of the questions about Chain Reaction before moving on, one of the fun things about Chain Reaction was the contestants were related in some way, whether it was two people or three people. Mm-hmm. Was it easy to get those kind of contestants again once you were able to search for them?
Yeah, it was. One of the things we did, I don't even know if people were so focused on it, with the prior Dylan Lane version, was there were always teams of three women against three men. We decided we didn't need to do that this time around, and that also opened it up so you could have groups of friends. Sometimes you have a married couple and one of the siblings or, you know, a group that does game nights, or they're all friends from the health club or whatever it might be. There's always some connection between the folks playing on either team.
Jay James from Game Show Network. He's the senior vice president there, charge of programming, production development, all sorts of things. He's with us this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. And GSN's latest effort, their third revival of Chain Reaction with the original revival host Dylan Lane back in the MC Square. He's with us. And Chain Reaction will begin Monday, February 22nd, 5 p.m. Eastern time on Game Show Network, available on cable and satellite. And got a question or comment for Jay in our remaining moments with him? Well, use your fingers and your voice and dial in 646-652-2906. Or use our chat room, SimonApple04. My name, and stay tuned before the top of the hour, our newest classic trivia question and prizes in play. So get your thinking caps ready. You could be our second classic trivia winner of 2021. Jay, it's been a big role for GSN going into 2021. Shows like America Says, Common Knowledge, Get a Clue, Masterminds, etc., all hits. What do you think is responsible for this, being on a roll and a roll and a roll?
I just think that... you know, I think it started with my boss, Fran Shea, who's the head of programming for the channel, decided to just really drill down on who our most loyal viewers were and are, and really just figured out that so many of our viewers are women, predominantly 50 plus, a lot living in the middle of the country, and we just kind of put a profile together of what and who these viewers are and the types of things that they respond to, and really what they were looking for, just kind of nostalgic type formats, family friendly, certainly play along sort of things. And so instead of trying to chase, you know, the younger, more fleeting audience, we just really leaned into, these are our loyal viewers. Let's just really super serve them and give them what they like, and try and, through these shows, through these originals, just develop kind of a network personality that's friendly and approachable and warm and fun. And that really filters into everything we do in developing these shows, everything from thinking through the sound effects. We don't have any loud, harsh buzzers, because that's negative and that makes you feel bad if you get something wrong and somebody's hitting you, you know, with a big red X and a loud buzzer, you know. So we actually take our wrong sound effects from the lower range of the correct sound effects libraries when we listen to them. So we also think in terms of, you know, how often people are getting a chance at grand prizes and things like that. You know, we want, you know, people to always feel like they've got a fair shot at things, and you can only control that. You really can't control it, but we just try and make the games accessible and at least have the feeling that you've always got a chance to win. And so, you know, again, that also filters into how we cast our hosts. We want our audience to feel genuinely that, like, if they ran into one of our hosts in the airport or a supermarket, our hosts would be friendly and warm to them. And that really comes through. And so the audience has responded to us in that way, and we're really happy about it. And they're also fun shows to make when you're there, because you're trying to give away money. And when you do, it's a great, great moment. It makes everybody so happy.
Yeah. How is Leah Remini and People Puzzler doing, which premiered a few weeks ago?
The show's doing great. Ratings-wise, it's phenomenal. Every day I open up the ratings email and, you know, my eyebrows go up with how well it's doing. So we're super thrilled about it. She just did her press tour over the last few weeks to support it. She was amazing, super funny. All the outlets wanted her to talk to her about it. And, you know, it's just a great combination, because we have People Magazine, which, now that you know a bit about our audience, you can tell that's a great match for our audience, because, you know, everybody is very familiar with and has positive feelings towards People Magazine. It's the crossword game in People, so it's not the New York Times crossword. It's an accessible, easier to play, oftentimes with celebrity and pop culture answers type crossword puzzle. So it's accessible. And, you know, and Leah's great in the show. She really connects with the contestants. She has a lot of fun with them, and they have fun with her, which she encourages. And and it's a pretty straightforward format, but it's fun to play. A lot of pretty images in all the game material, you know, of the celebrities and other things, and a good variety. So it's working for us. We're really, really happy with it.
And we have a call working for us. We're going to take it right now. Hello, you're on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hey, Simon. It's Rick Webb calling from sunny Philadelphia.
And, Rick, it's great to have you, and welcome to have you aboard. It's been a while, so go right ahead. You're on with Jay James with GSN.
Hey, James. Just a quick question. You had mentioned that a lot of your audience, especially for Chain Reaction, at that time period skews a little more like middle age and female. So my question is about the guests that are on the show. Like, just from what I've seen on Facebook and YouTube so far, it's kind of like the guests and the contestants seem to be a little bit more younger skewing, like in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. I think I know the answer to this, but like, why wouldn't the guest be older skewing as well?
It's a mix. It's one of those things where, you know, when you get into casting, you want people, you want good players, you want people who bring a lot of personality, and we're oftentimes just looking at a mix across all the demos. We don't try and just lean into one too much. And so, you know, a lot of it too is just kind of luck of the draw in terms of what you get when you go out kind of fishing for contestants in terms of who's responding. And again, there's criteria on it because we need a team of three and we need them to have some connection. And then to get through the process, they need to demonstrate that they're good players and they're going to bring a lot of energy. And so we're always just hoping for a fair distribution, you know, throughout all different types of demos and profiles of folks. And so I think you'll see over the course of the season, you'll see some teams in some of the older brackets.
Cool. Well, looking forward to checking the show out, and it looks great already. And from the past, I've really enjoyed that show as well, so I'll definitely be checking it out. So continued success.
Oh, great. Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Simon. Have fun in the snow.
You're very welcome, Rick. Take care. Enjoy your rest of your midweek. Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, joining us here on Tomorrow Be Televised. So, Jay, you're 2 months in, actually really a month and a half in, one new show on so far, one new show coming up. What's the rest of the year look like in terms of new games?
Well, new ones, we have a number of things in development. We'll be making a few new series later in the year to either, you know, premiere in the fourth quarter or in January for us. In the interim, we're doing more episodes of America Says and Common Knowledge. You know, that's the closest thing on the calendar for us. And then we're looking at all our other shows for when we can bring them back for more seasons. Part of the game is actually studio space and figuring out, especially with us and with COVID and needing to kind of have a very controllable environment, what's available and when we can get in there. And so that's a really kind of interesting game that goes on behind the scenes. So even though you're ready and you want to pull the trigger and get a show into production, there may not be a stage for a couple months for you to be able to get in there. But we're looking at overall, if all holds the plan, making something like 750 episodes of new shows in this calendar year.
And did I hear right that Common Knowledge is also going to be syndicated, that the first round of episodes will be syndicated this fall on broadcast, the same way America Said was 2 years ago?
Right. I'm not sure about that. I don't know what the final word is on that. I know it had a test. I know it was seriously in consideration. And I have to admit, I'm not an ace at the syndication game. I know there are a lot of different levers at play. And so I'm just really waiting for an update on that, like everybody else. I certainly hope so.
All righty, Chain Reaction with Dylan Lane back in the MC seat. And you can catch it starting Monday, February 22nd, 5 p.m. Eastern Time on Game Show Network. Check your list where Game Show Network is available in your area on cable and satellite. For more details about the programming online, two places to go, www.gameshownetwork.com or www.gsntv.com. Either way, we'll get you to the site. It's either Game Show Network or www.gameshownetwork.com or www.gsntv.com. Chain Reaction, February 22nd, the premiere, 5 p.m. Eastern time. Jay James, the wonderful executive behind GSN and Senior Vice President of Programming and so forth, thank you again for joining us. Good luck with the new CR. Best to Dylan Lane and crew, and hopefully many more games coming up for your network as we unfold this year.
Thanks so much, Simon. Appreciate your support.
You're very welcome. Take care. Enjoy.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Jay James, Senior Vice President at Game Show Network, joining us live from Santa Monica, California. Now time before the top of the hour for our classic trivia question of the week. We've got a brand new one for you, so get ready, because if you're first with the correct answer and you become our second classic trivia winner of 2021, you get the Genius Box, the book about how the Idiot Box got smart and is changing the TV business by David C. Tice of Hub Entertainment Research. Remember last month we had our good friend Frank D'Onofrio, the Elvis TV expert, who told you about his new book, Elvis, the King of Rock and Roll? Well, you can get that book as well, which is a big one on Amazon, if you know the answer to the following question. Coming up on our next half hour, we're going to showcase the 50th anniversary of Masterpiece Theater on PBS. And early this run, one of the other PBS shows that was inspired by Masterpiece Theater was a series produced here in New York called The Adams Chronicles. It was presented in 1976, the year of the bicentennial. Here's the question. Who played John Adams on The Adams Chronicle? Who played John Adams on The Adams Chronicle? If you know the answer, email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Don't forget to include your name and address. If you won before, let somebody else win. And let's see if we get a winner by the end of today. If not, we'll post the question tomorrow morning on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. At UBC Simon TWBT. One more time, the question, who played John Adams on The Adams Chronicles? If you know the answer, it's SimonApple04@yahoo.com. Remember, in order to win, you got to be in, so do so. And all the very best. When we come back, we have a big expert about Masterpiece Theater, which is marking its half century this year on PBS. From the University of Missouri, Dr. Nancy West joins us as we pause at the top of the hour for web identification. This is www.blogtalkradio.com, Spreaker.com, and TuneIn.com. Together, we reach over 50 million listeners around the world every month and growing. BTR is your home tonight for the Independent Music Showcase, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, only on Blog Talk Radio. Remember, best BTR 24/7. At YouTube.com. Welcome back to our final half hour of Tomorrow Be Televised, and welcome to those of you just joining us at the top of the hour. Great to have you aboard. 35 degrees at the top of the hour. Simon Apple with you live from New Haven, New York. Another great guest coming your way in this half hour. So be part of the action. Be interactive. Call in 646-652-2906. That's 646-652-2906. Numbers go anywhere. You're catching us across the country, around the globe, on Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, and TuneIn Radio. We also have our chat room going. SimonApple04 by name. Rick Webb, our friend from Philadelphia, made the call last half hour. Still in the room. So join him at SimonApple04. And again, you can find that at our homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. And joining us now from Columbia, Missouri, is one of the foremost experts on Masterpiece Theater on PBS, which this year marks 50 years on the air. From Columbia, Missouri, University of Missouri English professor, Dr. Nancy West. Dr. West, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome, Simon.
It is a pleasure. So why do you think Masterpiece Theater has reached the half-century mark?
Oh, I think there's lots of reasons for that. One is that it has a very, very devoted set of followers and audience that, I was always amazed when I was writing the book by how many people have watched the show for a really long time, in some cases for all 50 years. So there's that. I think it's a show that has consistently aimed to provide top quality drama, well-scripted, well-acted shows, shows that we can kind of trust to be good. And then there's all kinds of reasons having to do with our love of England, too.
What has surprised you about the run? Because it seems that it originally started as the BBC adapting famous classic literature, or doing original series like the first one, The First mm-hmm. Churchills, back in 1971, about historical figures. It seems that lately the focus has been more toward more popular culture, mystery kind of shows. Currently right now it is running the latest season of All Creatures Great and Small, which was a big hit for the BBC a number of decades ago, and now is coming back through Masterpiece.
Right. In some ways we've always, you know, we have this idea of Masterpiece Theater as being, you know, the show that adapts classic literature. And that's always been true. But even in its early decades in the 1970s, it would try to do other things. So, you know, there were the big grand adaptations of Henry James and Dostoevsky and other, you know, big hitting writers. But there were also mystery shows, too. There was the Lord Peter Wimsey detective series that was hugely popular on Masterpiece Theater. And there was Upstairs Downstairs, which ran from 1974 to 1977. And that wasn't classic literature at all. That was all original writing and designed to kind of provide audiences with a mix of melodrama and body humor and social history. So I would say, actually, that the show has always tried to mix things up. But there is the sense, I think, too, that in more recent years, ever since it relaunched in 2008, it's tried to hit a much younger audience and to kind of get out of, you know, its reputation for being your parents' drama, your parents' television show. Yeah, so the look and the feel of it is much, much different now than it certainly was in the 70s or 80s.
Yeah, and we should point out that at one point, the success of Masterpiece Theater actually, and the Lord Peter Wimsey Mysteries, actually provoked WGBH, the sponsoring station in Boston of for PBS, to do a separate series called Mystery, which ran for quite a spell, which again was, you know, mystery series that that the BBC did. And the BBC certainly has a grasp, I think, more than any other country in terms of doing really terrific mystery characters.
Yes, it does. Yeah, in 1980, I think Masterpiece Theater had been doing so well that Mobil Oil, which used to sponsor Masterpiece for many, many years, one of its agents called up WGBH and said, you know, how'd you like to do another show? I mean, every producer's dream. And WGBH said, okay. And Mobil said, let's do a mystery, a British mystery series this time. So they got, you know, the first host was Gene Shalit, and then it was Vincent Price for about 8 or 9 years. And then when he got too old and sick for the part, Diana Rigg took over. And that show was enormously successful. And, I think a lot of Americans really love British mysteries because there's this sense that we're getting a darker side to England. But at the same time, it's all sort of wrapped up in, you know, kind of a cozy feel as well. Yeah. Although Mystery did take some awfully big risks. It did Prime Suspect in the 1990s, which was hardly cozy feeling at all. That was maybe one of its very best shows with Helen Mirren as the star.
One of the great, I think, portrayals ever in television history.
Absolutely.
The role he had in Prime Suspect.
I agree.
Dr. West, how did WGBH and the BBC come together with Mobil Oil sponsorship to do Masterpiece Theater in the first place?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so, I mean, it all happened very, very slapdash, very quick. There was a new president of WGBH. He took over in June of 1969 or 1970, and he had this idea of doing this British series when he was in London. So he called up the BBC, made a cold call to them, and worked out this arrangement where he would get a year's worth of programming for just a couple $100,000, which was dirt, dirt cheap. And so he came back and, you know, with a group of other people, they selected the lineup for that year. But they needed money. This is PBS. They, you know, they didn't have any sources. So they contacted over 40 companies before a man named Herb Schmertz at Mobil Oil agreed to do it. And Mobil Exxon sponsored Masterpiece Theater for a total of 22 years, I think. Very, very long time. Yeah.
And I believe the WGBH executive you're referring to is Christopher Sarson, who, among his other accomplishments there, did a little thing called Zoom, one of the best programs ever. And speaking of interactive television, that was the show where kids across the country were invited to send in ideas for segments, and the cast would do them.
Oh, I didn't know that. You mean right on the spot they would do it? Oh, that's wonderful.
Either on the spot or they would consider them for and produce segments out of their suggestions or their drawings, their ideas. And for those who know, you may remember the famous theme song, Come On and Zoom, Zoom, Zoom.
I do.
Great show. Some of YouTube should find the WJ vaults and bring that show back. Also, Frontline, should point out, is another program that in part came out of WGB. I think it was under Sarson's run or shortly after. So GBH, of course, one of the great producing stations in the PBS hierarchy. I'm also wondering whether part of Masterpiece came out of the success a few years earlier of the Foresight Saga, which was series that PBS presented on Sunday nights in what would be Masterpiece Theater's time period.
Yes. It actually wasn't PBS that ran the Foresight Saga. It was something called NET, the National Education Television, which got started in the 1950s. And the reason that NET did it was because none of the commercial networks wanted to touch it. They thought, oh, are you kidding? It's period drama. It's black and white. Nobody in America is going to be interested in this show, even though it had been a sensation, an absolute phenomenon in England. ABC, CBS, and NBC all turned up their noses at it. So NET wound up purchasing it for a song, and they ran it. It ran for 26 episodes, and, you know, it wasn't as big a phenomenon in America as it was in England. I mean, in England, it actually shut down pubs, and, you know, ministers had to rearrange vespers and masses because, you know, people who would normally go to church at that time were home watching the Foresight Saga. But it was very popular here. And if you look through, say, old issues of the New York Times or the New Yorker magazine, you see all these cartoons, you know, with people sitting around the television and joking about how they were spending the evening with the Foresights. And I think a lot of people loved it here. And that was the first show to bring the whole idea of the miniseries to America. Americans had never seen anything like this, where you would have a serial drama, but one that had a definite ending to it. So you got the pleasure of the long, you know, continuous story, something you could really immerse yourself in, but we knew it was going to come to an end eventually. And that had a big influence on Masterpiece. Yeah, they thought, why not do this all the time? Let's get other miniseries and make a whole collection out of them.
We're speaking with Dr. Nancy West. She is a professor at the University of Missouri, and we're talking about the half century of Masterpiece Theater, which marks that 50th anniversary time this year on your local PBS station. Masterpiece Theater, by the way, is now running the new season of All Creatures Great and Small, Sunday nights at 9 p.m. Eastern time on many PBS stations. Don't forget, when you're talking about PBS programming, some stations play it at that hour, some play it later or earlier in the day, and some play it later in the week. So you have to check your local listings, not only for the PBS station in your area, but when they play Masterpiece Theater, or it goes by Masterpiece, or now, this year, Masterpiece 50. Dr. West joins us from Columbia, Missouri, which is between Kansas City and St. Louis, this half hour on Tomorrow Be Televised. Simon, I'm with you from the eastern coast of Nueva York, where it's 35 degrees at the top of the hour. No snow today. We make it a little tomorrow. We'll have to see if a storm coming from the Midwest kicks us up a little bit up north. So we'll see. Anyway, no question or comment for Dr. West, give us a call, 646-652-2906, or use our chat room, SimonApple04 by name. Don't forget, Monday we're not going to be with you, as we usually are, because of President's Day, but we will be with you with a 90-minute edition on Tuesday, 24 hours later. We'll have the Chief Executive Officer of the popular multi-channel bundle you can get on smart TV sets and smart devices, Xumo, X-U-M-O, Colin Petrie-Norris, Internet Radio exclusive. We'll also talk to the founder and president of a company called Enthusiast Gaming that now has a gaming app on Samsung smart TV sets. His name is Menashe Kestenboom, the founder and president. And we'll also have the executive producer of a very controversial documentary miniseries now running on HBO called The Lady and the Dale. Executive producer Andre Gaines will be with us. That series, by the way, we also were playing on HBO Max. So be sure to join us Tuesday, not Monday, Tuesday of next week, 3:50 Eastern Pacific, right here on Tomorrow Will Be Televised. Anyway, Dr. West, initially, one of the other things I think made Masterpiece Theater work was the host, the great Alistair Cook, one of the best personalities to ever step from across the Atlantic to the United States. What kind of role did he play in the success of Masterpiece, at least early on?
He played a huge role. I mean, he kind of was masterpiece theater, you know. And when you mentioned Christopher Sarson, the first executive producer, when he tried to think about who the perfect host would be for the TV show, Alistair Cook was really the only name that came to mind. I mean, here was this man who came from England. He was born in a very working-class town, raised in a working-class family, but he transformed himself and went to Cambridge, had this air of the British gentleman about him, then spent many years in America, fell in love with the country, and did those letters from America for the BBC where he would every week do a radio show, you know, reporting back to his fellow countrymen what life in America was like. And so he was kind of this cultural mediator between America and England, and an ambassador. And so that made him sort of just the perfect person to sit down and translate and explain British culture to American viewers of Masterpiece. He was also elegant, he was charming, he was handsome, he was witty. He was perfect, just perfect.
Mm-hmm. Something else that just hit was that at least in its first decade or two, the Masterpiece Theater was one of the very few places where you could find British actresses in lead roles. Susan Hampshire, I believe from the first Churchills on, Jean Marsh in Upstairs, Downstairs, mm-hmm. Gemma Jones, the Duchess of Duke Street, and on and on and on. It was one of the few places anywhere in television where you had actresses in lead roles on a consistent basis.
Yes, yeah, and that has always been true of the show. It's still true of the show. It's, you know, I think in some ways the producers pick shows that speak to the majority of Masterpiece's audience, which are women, right? And women who are a little bit older, women in their 30s, 40s, 50s. So the show kind of mirrors back to a lot of its viewers, women like them, right? Or women that they hope or imagine themselves to be. When you keep going down that list, you have Helen Mirren, you have Keeley Hawes, who played the fantastic role of Louisa Durrell in the Durrells at Corfu. She's my all-time favorite television mother. And now there's the new detective series with the female detective. I've forgotten the name of it, but she's fierce and tough and great. And All Creatures Great and Small, which you keep mentioning, has the character of Helen, who's also, you know, this tough, suffer no fools farm woman and manager of an estate. Yeah, that's a wonderful point, Simon. I totally agree with that.
And let's also remember a little thing called Downton Abbey with not one but two magnificent actresses, namely Maggie Smith and Michelle Dockery.
Yes, actually, I think you could keep going with that list, too. I think Penelope Wilton is fantastic on that show. The sisters, the woman who, Laura Carmichael, Leslie Nichols, who plays Mrs. Patmore, the cook, the woman who plays Mrs. Hughes, the housekeeper. I'm blanking on her name right now. It's an ensemble cast. So there's not one woman who really takes the lead in that show, but they all get their, you know, their moment in the sun. They all get a good bit of air time because it's ensemble acting, and they play off of each other, and they present different ways of being a really tough, fierce woman. Yeah.
Of all the Masterpiece episodes, miniseries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Do you see one or two that maybe when they were picked, there was a sense of, well, if it works, it works. If it doesn't, no sweat on us. And it ended up working more than expected in sort of a fantastic way.
Oh, you felt like they really took a risk?
They took a risk. I mean, Downton Abbey, for example, I think is one of the more recent examples of really taking a risk. And it worked beyond everybody's, I think, expectation.
Right, right. They had no idea that it was going to fly the way that they did. Although when it started airing in England, in Britain, the season before, you know, it came on several months before it premiered here in January. So Masterpiece had already bought it by that time, but they had a feeling it was going to do really well here because it was just soaring in Britain. But I would say another show, one that absolutely comes to mind is I, Claudius, which was done here in 79. And that show was a tremendous risk because it had so much nudity to it, so much violence, so much perversity. I mean, even now when I rewatch it, I think, wow, I can't believe this was on the small screen back in the 70s. So everybody just kind of held their breath and kept their fingers crossed. And they didn't know what Americans would do with it because Americans tend to be more prudish, I think, about nudity and violence, at least back then, than their British counterparts were. And yet we loved it. We thought it was sensational. So that would be a classic example. Upstairs, Downstairs was another one because it was very different from the more formal kind of classic adaptations that had preceded it. Let me see, what are some other good examples? Oh, in 2005, they did an adaptation by Andrew Davis of Bleak House. And Bleak House,
Charles,
you know,
Dickens
is
novel.
It's a long-ass novel, long novel, and not his most popular novel. And it requires an awful lot of, you know, editing and sort of figuring out what the spine of the story is, you know, 900 pages long. And Davis said he decided that the story was all about a daughter and her mother. And he also decided with the producers that they and director that they were going to film it over 15 episodes that were only 45 or 40 minutes long, and that the camera would move very, very quickly, and that it would have a kind of CSI look to it, right? Because it is a crime novel. And so there were all sorts of risks involved in that. You know, dealing with a novel that's not very popular, adapting a whole new kind of look and feel and pacing for period drama. And it, too, became quite a sensation, especially in Britain, but over here it did really well, too. Little Dorrit, which came out in 2010, that was another one, totally out of the blue, and then swept up the Emmys that year. And people were just turning their heads saying, where did this come from?
Yeah, by the way, speaking of I, Claudius, very quickly, I always love that opening with the snake. That snake,
yeah,
that swirling snake, and the theme music was one of the best pieces of theme music I think any Masterpiece Theater series ever had was that theme music. Just absolutely amazing. I don't know who the composer was, but it was something special. We only have about a minute or so left, and I wanted to get your thoughts in about this book you've written. When did you write the book, and how is it available?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
Talk about the book very quickly, the book you put together on Masterpiece Theater. How did it just come out? It's been around for some time. How's it doing?
It just came out about 2 months ago, and it's doing really well. Actually, it's now in its fourth printing, and it's available on Amazon in hardcover, and it has an inset of 48 beautiful photographs. I'm very pleased and proud of the book. Thank you for asking about it.
You're very, very well. The name of the book is? Just to get the book name?
The book is called Masterpiece, America's 50-Year-Old Love Affair with British Drama.
There you go. And again, it's available at bookstores, also through Amazon.com and show other things. And I'll tell you what, Dr. West, we'd love to have it as a classic trivia prize. So we're going to talk to your publicist about maybe offering it as an upcoming classic trivia question prize on future
Wonderful.
Episodes. Again,
okay.
Masterpiece Theater, 50 years old and still growing strong. On your local PBS station, in many stations around the country, it's Sunday night at 9 p.m. Eastern time or 9 p.m. Pacific time. Remember, when you check for your local PBS station, check to when they play Masterpiece. Some play it at that time, some later in the night on Sunday, some earlier, others later days, and sometimes they have a replay on the weekends too. For more details about Masterpiece and what it's up to, Beyond All Creatures Great and Small, pbs.org. That's pbs.org. Dr. Nancy West, thank you again for joining us. It's been an absolute delight. good luck with the book. Happy it's doing well so far. And all the very best to you and your great work at the University of Missouri. It's been a real pleasure.
And you too, Simon. Good night.
You too. Take care. Dr. Nancy West joining us live from Columbia, Missouri. Again, her book is available at local bookstores around the country, also through Amazon. And we're going to see if we can also offer it very soon as a classic trivia question prize. Before we leave you, we have some words for the fine folks at Audible.com, our sponsor. There's an interesting book that just came out. It deals with Dust Bowl, Texas in the U.S. of A. in the 30s. It's called The Four Winds, very interesting book by Kristen Hanna. And it's a bestseller in a bookstore, but now it's a bestseller audiobook-wise, and that could be a book you get right now through Audible.com. Remember, Audible.com is the leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment, information, and inspiration. We're on 200,000 titles to choose from. Listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now, at Blog Talk Radio, a speaker, to the radio, et cetera, et cetera. Just sign up at audibletrial.com/televised. It's audibletrial.com/televised. Get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service, plus great customer service from Audible's parent, Amazon.com. And remember, if you're already an Amazon Prime member, that's two audiobooks you get for the trial of one. For all the details, go to audibletrial.com/televised. What a great 90 minutes we had for you this Wednesday afternoon. I want to thank all of our guests for being on and all of you for tuning in. Remember, we're back with you on Friday, our third of three episodes this week. Joining us will be from the new Amazon series, The Hunter's Anthology, producer Arezou Akmal and writer-director Robert Smithline. And also coming your way, formerly of Celebrity Deathmatch on MTV, animator Eric, the executive producer of the new Peacock series, Archibald's Next Big Thing, is here. If you came in late on today's program, want to catch up on episodes you missed, go to the homepage, blogtalkradio.com/televised. Check out our podcasts. They're available for you 24/7 at iTunes, Apple TV, Amazon Music, Verbal, iHeartRadio, their podcast network, other podcast sites as well. What did you think about today's program? What's your thought for where TV is at and where it's going? What do you like about Masterpiece Theater and its 50 years on the air on PBS? Or about the brand-new series Clarice and the work of Jane Lumet and her father, Sidney Lumet, including her work in television? We'd love to hear. So email me, simonapple04@yahoo.com. It's simonapple04@yahoo.com. Remember, that's how you get involved in our classic trivia question. One more time, the question is, who played John Adams on The Addams Chronicles? It was on PBS, Bicentennial Year, 1976. Don't forget, you also follow me on Facebook and on Twitter at UBC Simon TWBT. However you get in contact with us, we get in contact with you, and we do respond within 24 hours. Why? Because what you say matters. The views expressed here are those of the participants, not only those of Blog Talk Radio and other streamers of this program. Our production associate is Mandolin. Andy Toe is Blog Talk Radio's general manager, with Jay Sonnenberg, head of content. The co-founders, Alan Levy and Bob Cherish. Tomorrow We Televise was brought to you by Audible.com and Amazon Division. Remember, Audible transformed the way you hear the world. For 1 or 2 free audiobooks and much more, and a one-month trial, audibletrial.com/televised. But tomorrow We Televise, I'm Simon Applebaum in New York. Thank you for listening. Have a great rest of your midweek. We're back with you less than 48 hours from now, Friday, 3 p.m. Eastern, New Pacific, you know where, Blog Talk Radio, Speaker, TuneIn Radio, Verbal, Amazon Music, and the iHeartRadio Podcast Network. Whatever you're up to now and then, please make it safe and definitely make it great, and we will lift this pandemic